I heard some talk around this town, talk about you and me. How fool fell in love with you.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. I'm so glad you're here. And today, I am happy, I'm pleased as punch to have Carl Phillips back here in the studio at WCBN FM for the second week of school. Thanks for coming down, Carl, and being here.
Thanks for having me. Well, it's great to be back.
It's good to see you back. And we've got Jason behind the glass, and a shout out to Sarah Min for the brilliant show, Jazz Till Whenever, which today is Living Writers. Uh-huh. And Carl Phillips is here, everybody. Carl, you've been to Ann Arbor a few times. You're a friend of the show. You've been on Living Writers. But it's been like donkey's years now. I feel like...
I know. I can't remember when I was last here for the show anyway.
It was a while ago. And you've been to... And that wasn't your first time in Ann Arbor. You've been to the University of Michigan many a time.
Yeah.
What's it like being back fall 2025?
Well, my memory is that whenever I've been here before, it's been freezing. So, so it's interesting to see what it's like in nice weather. And I just realized this is the beginning of school, and because one big change is I've retired. So this whole academia thing to me is just suddenly forgotten. And I thought, what's going on? Everyone's looking very anxious. And I thought, oh, that's right. School just started.
Slightly sweaty.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm glad you came to witness this and to be part of it.
Yeah.
Quite honestly. And where did you fly in from today, Carl?
From Boston.
Oh, okay. Is that the closest airport to, because
I live I went back to Massachusetts after I retired last year and moved back home. So Boston's about an hour and a half away.
And when you say you moved back home, because in some of the poems here, because today on the table, we've got your latest Out with FSG, Scattered Snows to the North. And we also have on the table, because I haven't got to speak with you since the book, and your winner of the Pulitzer Prize book, Carl Phillips here.
Wild.
It's wild. Then the War and Selected Poems, 2007 to 2020. Yeah, wild. And
yeah,
so happy.
I'm glad. I mean, glad you're happy. I still don't really know what to make of it all, but it was fun when it happened, and it feels nice, I guess. on to the next poem. It doesn't make the writing any different. It's just as hard. And, so that's as it should be, I think.
I wonder if it made the writing different in a way where you felt freer in some way. Or do you think, because now, how many books do you have, Carl? A bundle?
Yeah, I think 17 or 18. But, the thing is, I think getting a big prize like that does affect a lot of people when it comes to what they're going to write next. But I feel that I know... Some people are going to disagree with this listening. But
this is your hour, Carl Phillips.
But I feel that I've always kind of done my own thing and been a little on the fringes. And some people would say, no, Carl, you've been at the center of things. But I always have been wondering, like, why do I not fit in some way with what seems to be whatever the ruling modes of poetry are? So I've been used for a long time to sort of living that way. Or I should say, even if that's not true career-wise, that's how I grew up, between being biracial, being queer, but not really knowing that part when I was a kid. So I've always sort of lived outside of the norm, which means, on one hand, it can be lonely, but on the other hand, it means that you just sort of do your own thing with a kind of confidence, because you're not expecting to be included, which is a strange way to put it, but it's very freeing. So for me, I feel like, it's great to get a prize and have acknowledgement, but it's for things I've been doing all along anyway, and it doesn't change. It doesn't create an anxiety about what to write next, or because I feel like, well, you'll just write the next thing you have to write because you were never writing in order to get a prize. So, yeah.
And that makes complete sense. And also, thank goodness, the Pulitzer Prize Committee is recognizing like a body of work and a way of working.
Yeah, no, that part was thrilling. And
as well as the particular book, too.
Sure.
I understand that.
No, it's thrilling. And but I always think I've always been skeptical, too, about prizes as much as they're wonderful to get. But I think too many people mistake them for proof of having of being good. And, you know, it's hard to know in our own lifetime whether our poems are lasting or good, whatever good is in art. It's so subjective anyway. So I always used to tell my students, you better be writing the poems you feel you have to write for yourself. And then if for some reason it fits in with the zeitgeist and people want to read it, people want to award you, that's great. But also, if you never get those things, if you really were writing just for yourself, then you're not going to be disappointed. And because I think a lot of people just plummet when they pin their hopes on these sort of signs of affirmation. Yeah.
Yes. These outside signs of affirmation. Mm-hmm. You see, art is hard and lonely sometimes.
Yeah.
But also sometimes it's the necessary thing. And if it's necessary, sure, then it's not even really brave to do it. It just means you must do it.
That's how I feel. But you know, I've been told that's a little naive. Some people say that's naive. And I also am aware that sometimes people have to write for their promotion at work. In academia, you can't just always sit around and say, well, I'll just wait 10 years until I've written something if you want to get your promotion. So I understand there are those pressures for people.
Right.
Yeah.
And does it feel good to be outside of like the superstructure of academia now?
Yes, but I never feel like I was part of it. I mean, I taught in a writing program, but I didn't train to be an academic. I fell into it by accident. And
with some books.
Yeah, and was a high school teacher. That had been what I trained to be. So I didn't, I never quite meshed with the academic. It was a place to work, but
some stability.
Yeah, but it didn't define who I am. But I realize now that I'm retired from it that there is an immense swath of time that seems to be free from things that, to my mind, never mattered. Department meetings, you know, different subcommittees, all the things that, having been at the same school for 30 years, and I saw that by the time I was leaving, they were still trying to work out things that they had a subcommittee for when I started. And so I thought, you know, at least I don't have to spend my time thinking I'm literally losing my life over something that's not going to matter
anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you were contributing to the cause for those 30 years.
I mean, it always mattered to me to be in the classroom and to be teaching. That was the point. And that's the high school teacher in me that wanted to sort of, you know, trigger enthusiasm for learning. But that's so set apart from, you know, departmental minutiae.
Yeah. And the institution keeping itself going.
Yeah.
Yeah. It can feel Sisyphean.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a word I haven't heard in a while. But it can.
I feel like Sisyphus is always...
Yes.
always near. No, that's... That's sorry to take that grim turn, Carl. Well, I'm so happy to have you here. I don't know why.
Well, I'm the one who led it down this dark road of academia as if, you know, there's no joy in it. There's plenty of joy, and I don't mean to dismiss those who want to, you know, be deans or whatever people want to do. You know, it's all important.
Yeah, because I think we have to, we you worked in a university, as you said, for 30 years. I'm working here at one. Mm-hmm. We have to believe in maybe not be as naive as maybe some of the idealistic things are part of the university, but
sure.
We have to, like, I mean, I'm still spending time here, Carl. So I have to believe in the, like, this is also the route to find the students and the ideas and the, yeah.
No, I think that's true. I just think it's, I don't think academia is naturally built to accommodate artists.
Yes.
And so,
yes.
You know,
and it's such a,
that's the
look at the
frustration.
Whole system that's been built in our country, especially.
Right. And there's a push to quantify everything. And so I would often be asked when I had a semester leave, you know, how to quantify my research for poems. And it's hard to explain to somebody that...
Did you just give them your walking paths?
Well, research could be something like that. Yes, walking through the woods. You know, it sounds very lazy. You know, you could be lying on the beach, but this is where your ideas might come to.
There's so many shores and water edges in this latest book of yours.
Yeah.
Carl.
So I think, it's hard to make that fit in some measurable system. But I also understand why numbers are needed to, you know, justify grants and all of that. And makes sense.
When the grants were there for the getting. Now I'm doing it. I'm not going to keep doing it. In fact, before, you know what, I can see how I've missed you, Carl. I've looked forward to this since I've always remembered our last meeting here on Living Writers so fondly.
It was fun.
Let me read your short. What I love about this bio on the back of your latest book out with FSG, Scattered Snows to the North, is that it's very brief. So we'll have lots of things to talk about too. Things that I'm not sure we got to even in our first conversation those years ago. Mm-hmm. But here's the bio in the back of Scattered Snows to the North. Carl Phillips is the author of Then the War and Selected Poems, 2007 to 2020, for which he received the Pulitzer Prize. He lives on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. Carl, do you still have your dog?
Well, I have a dog, not the same one.
Okay.
I've had a few dogs since.
And what, what could you, there's a dog poem in Scattered Snows to the North, and there's also a pair of spaniels that appear as an image in another poem. Mm-hmm. How is your present dog?
She's great. Her name is Roxy.
Oh.
And I guess she's a pit bull. I was told she was a Staffordshire Terrier, but people tell me that's just a euphemism for a pit bull.
It's the same. Yeah,
yeah.
Same.
But no one knows she's a pit bull because she doesn't have the docked ears, so she looks more like a kind of wombat. Which I like. And I don't know, I've only had her a few months, so she's been fine. I was told she was housebroken. She wasn't, so.
How did you find each other?
Oh, just going to the Animal Rescue League in town. And, you know, I always get rescue dogs.
And your eyes met?
Yeah, well, really my partner saw this dog. I was a little intimidated and thought she didn't look too friendly. But anyway, she's very friendly. And, yeah, so.
And now she's part of the family.
She is, yes.
And I imagine getting to go by the ocean. Is the Atlantic your favorite ocean?
It is, but that suggests I've been to a whole bunch of them. I haven't been to all of the oceans in the world.
Now's the time,
but,
Carl. You've been
I guess
at
so.
Retirement.
I guess so, but then I'd have to leave my house. So, you know, I try not to. Try to stay home. Yeah.
And well, it sounds like in the poems that, I mean, I have to say, I love your latest book. That's just beautiful. Maybe we'll take a short break. And when we come back, would you mind reading a poem for us to kick us off?
Of course.
Today on Living Writers, Carl Phillips is here. Scattered Snows to the North, out with FSG. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason Voss behind the glass. We'll be back.
I'm
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time. Today, Carl Phillips is here in the studio. The book on the table, his latest book of poems, Scattered Snows to the North. Carl, thanks for choosing songs for today's program and choosing them on the fly. And, and Jason magically getting all of them. Toot sweet. Unbelievable.
Thank you, Jason.
Yes.
Thank you.
Carl always believed in Jason, every step of the way, which is not to say that I don't always, but Carl knew it right away. And that, thanks for that Portishead, Carl. I haven't heard Portishead in a little while. And you need a dose every now and again, I feel like.
Oh, yeah, weekly.
Really? And is that like one of your go-to albums? Like Portishead? Yes. Yeah, that's a top one for me too.
Yeah.
When we first started talking, you mentioned returning to your home, like where you grew up.
Yeah.
What was it like for you, Carl, like writing? Like, were you, when you were a little kid, were you writing poems then? Did you find writing, because you have a, there's a poem in here where you are a young boy, I believe, or the narrator is a young boy. Sorry.
That's fine.
Thanks for saying that.
It's so always it's just the Further Adventures of Carl.
There's this line, I think I'm not conflating poems, but where it's like, I am a lighthouse, I am a lighthouse. And I just love that part. But were you, when you were like a, when you were a little boy, were you aware that you were the poet Carl Phillips already as a lighthouse?
No. That would be a very precocious thing to be thinking. No, never thought about, I guess I thought about writing poems because my mother wrote little poems for my sisters and me, but, you know, just for fun and, you know, birthday card poems, that kind of thing. So, no, that was never a plan.
Was she then, so she wrote poems. Was that something that she did all her life, or was it just one of many things she did?
Yeah, I guess one of many things. I mean, she painted, you know, but she was one of those, I want to say 50s housewives, you know, stay-at-home moms. So I think she had a lot of talents. I don't know if they were all, you know, given room for her to enjoy. But yeah.
What did she think when you started writing poems? Were you like in college, or were you?
Yeah, I was in college, and I think she thought it was great. And but I hadn't started writing the poems that would end up being like poems for my first book onward. That took a while to get around to. And then she would read all the books as they came out. And her usual question, she would just say, I just want to know if you're happy. So that was her concern, that the poems didn't, I guess, suggest that I was happy. So, yeah, there's that.
And what would you say to her?
I'd say I am, because I am. But there are many things in life that you wrestle with that aren't always about being happy, and those are the things I'm drawn to write about. So I'm not drawn to write about joy, you know, or leisure, and because I'm busy when I'm experiencing joy, having it. I don't need to analyze it. You know, whereas when we're in a moment of disappointment and we think, why? Why did this happen? So, you know, that's a conundrum. And to me, that's what makes poetry, is having something that you're pushing up against. But with joy, it's like, sure, this is great.
I let it flow.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although it feels like in Scattered Snows to the North, there's lots of space for joy and the movement.
Sure. Well, that's also because I see joy, I think, maybe in different ways from some people. I mean, I feel like experience joy throughout every day, but it can be something small, you know, watching a chipmunk emerge from its hole and grab an acorn or something, which is not a big deal, but it's a small moment of joy. Or, you know, releasing a wasp trapped on the screen porch is joyful to me. And, but I think sometimes people are thinking joy has to be some big event, you know, but it's like, oh, this is nice, a nice reminder of things going on in the world, independent of our human, you know, weighty frustrations and fears.
Yes.
You know, it's good to know that.
There's lovely lines you have in a poem about humans are animals, but animals aren't human. This seems like a puzzle without, like, I'm not doing it mm-hmm. justice, but this.
Yeah, I know. I don't remember it either, but I know what you're talking about. it's in one of those longer poems. And yeah, it's one of the things that I find, it's why animals appear so often in my poems, is because I'm envious, I suppose, of how they don't have human self-consciousness. So as I understand it, an animal doesn't wake up and think, is today the last day I'll be living? What is mortality? You know, I mean, I know animals do understand when they're dying, but I don't think there's that kind of fear of, oh, I'm getting older now. What's the future hold? There's also not the same kind of responsibilities. I mean, animals do raise their young, but kind of in an indifferent way. And then they move on, and which is very different from me dealing with my 91-year-old father, for example, and trying to help him, which is not what probably squirrels need to do. They don't have to deal with their elders, because the elders die in a timely manner, because that happens in the animal world.
Is your dad nearby, Carl?
Yes, he is. He's about 20 minutes away.
Oh, that's good then.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, squirrels don't have that concern.
Right.
They have other concerns.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's something about that. But I'm not the first one to notice that. I mean, that's like Keats envying the nightingale, because the nightingale sings simply because it sings, not because it's self-conscious about being a musician or a poet or something. So it's just, you know, how freeing that would be.
Yes.
But there are, you know, some good things about being human, I guess. Plus, what's...
Okay, name three.
Well, I mean, you know, we don't just randomly... I was going to say we don't just randomly get attacked by a hawk or something, but we get randomly attacked
maybe
by other things.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like life is any
less
treacherous.
Yeah. Like a bus or, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. True. But we're safe from the hawks for the most part.
For the most part.
There's many images, like you said, like of the animals within, and many images of landscape, the mm-hmm. natural world, again in Scattered Snows to the North. Also all the seasons are represented.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Could we hear a poem and then we'll
sure.
talk more?
Okay. Sure. Why don't I read the title poem?
Lovely.
Scattered Snows to the North. Does it matter that the Roman Empire was still early in its slow unwinding into never again? Then, as now, didn't people burst into tears in front of other people or in private for no reason that they were willing to give, or they weren't yet able to, or for just no reason? I've never stopped missing you, I used to practice saying, for when I'd need those lines, as I assumed I would, given what I knew then, nothing really, about things like love, trust, the betrayal of trust, and a willfulness that's only deepened inside me all these years, during which I can almost say I've missed no one, though it hurts to say it. Honestly, the Roman Empire, despite my once having studied it, barely makes any sense to me now, past the back and forthing of patrolled borders as the gauge and proof of hunger's addictive and erosive powers. But there were people, of course, too, most of them destined to be unremembered, who filled in their drawn lives anyway, because what else is there, to where the edges gave out. If it was night, they lit fires, presumably. Tears were tears. As indeed they are. Sometimes tears are just tears, and they've happened for centuries. So it's comforting to know that every once in a while when one bursts into tears.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, which I actually think is a useful thing to do routinely, cry.
And can you?
Well, I mean, not like I sit there and say, it's
now's
now
the time.
Right? Like the crying hour. But
that's the next book, right? But, that's a manuscript is in your bag.
Sure. But every once in a while, I think, oh, I think I'm about to cry. I think I guess here it goes. And then it happens. And it's like, oh, that felt better. It was good. That was necessary. And sometimes there's a reason. And sometimes it's like, I don't know why that came over me, but, you know.
That's true. And some things where you'd be, like your poem says as well, like you're surprised by it. Like there seems no reason, but yet there is. There's something happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, your last lines, I love them.
Well, thank you. Those are the hardest to get usually. So, you know, that's the whole problem. Like that's the question people always ask me at Q&As. How do you know when a poem is finished? It's like, if I could tell you, I'm not holding back, I would tell you.
Right.
But, and because they always act as if, oh, you have the secret, Carl. You just don't want to share it. But I don't. What I do now say to them is, I say, well, how do you know when you're in love? And how is it that you know when you have fallen out of love? Because whatever the answer is to those is related to the answer to how you know a poem is finished. It's some kind of, it's a feeling. And that's how it is.
Mm. And if you looked at a poem a different time, you might have a different feeling.
Yes, you might.
But maybe not. Because sometimes it is itself, and it's just itself, and then somehow distant.
Yeah, maybe it's like a piece of abstract art, you know, where I think you really can come away each time. You're a different person each time you look at the painting. So say it's a painting. And I do think that's true about a poem. I've noticed this like when I had to do Selected. So there you are going back to earlier work. Or for example, my first book is being reprinted and coming out in March of this coming year.
Oh, great.
And so I no longer had a copy, digital copy of it, because it was before computers. So I had to type out this whole book, and so I could send it as a, you know, document.
So interesting.
Yeah, and it was very strange and somewhat painful, actually, to go through each of these poems. I thought, I have not read this book basically since it came out in 92. And it's like, wow. There's a lot that you did not know you were going to figure out about yourself. And it's weird to sort of watch these poems where you see yourself, your younger self, struggling with something that now seems like, oh, here's the answer. Here's all you have to do. But you don't have that. You didn't have that knowledge back then. You know, kind of like looking at a picture of yourself as a troubled teen and thinking, you know, I wish I could have told you it will work out, but who knew that? So, yeah.
And so interesting that you see yourself in these poems.
Oh, sure.
And the questions that you are asking
or the
revelations you also maybe were getting towards, like, you know, in the movement of becoming even a.
Well, my first book was really, I mean, I feel the first book outed me. I didn't even understand I was queer and was writing these poems, I think, as a, you know, nowadays maybe somebody would go to therapy. But at the time, it seemed as if there was no alternative to, I mean, the idea of coming out was not an option to me. The idea of, I was married, and the idea of getting divorced, which now seems like that's an easy thing to do, but it's not emotionally.
No.
If you actually care about the person you're married to. And so it's, so in that sense, it was very strange to read those poems and to sort of think, oh, there is a lot about to happen when this book comes out and everything's going to hit the fan. But for the, ultimately for the good of everyone. But yeah.
Yeah. Cause as we're growing or becoming who we are, it's painful as well as as exciting. And
But that's what I mean about making art because you have to, you know. So I wasn't putting a book together to figure out how to win a contest or how to get into a, get an academic job or something like that. I feel, I've said before in interviews, that I felt I was writing for my life and truly trying to figure out a space to put this confusion down in a way that made sense to me then. And that's, when you're doing that, you're not writing in order to be published or to, it's very private. And so, you know, that's not the only way to write, but that's how I write.
It almost feels like that would be like a type of manifesto for you, like the why, like why you write.
Yeah, exactly. So,
writing for my life.
Mm-hmm. I silenced you.
Only momentarily, Carl.
I was going to say, we're not allowed to have much silence on air, are we?
We're freeform, so we work with the pauses,
I
too.
See.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But thank you. Yeah, thank you for caring, like in case the FCC is swooping in.
Sure.
No, we can have some silence. We just can't swear it up. We can't do a lot of... No. But you know what? This is a good time for a break.
Okay.
We'll hear another one of your song picks.
Okay.
Today on Living Writers, Carl Phillips is here. And we shall return after this break. You've got Living Writers, The Book on the Table, Scattered Snows to the North. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
Stand to be alone. Think you should.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Today, Carl Phillips is here in the studio. Carl, thanks for choosing the songs again.
Of course. Sorry it took me a while to get them chosen.
Oh, please. But, you know. No apologies ever. Not at all. Plus, sometimes isn't it better to do things on the fly, you know, sometimes and see what happens in the moment as well?
Yes, sometimes. Oh. although I'm told, and it's true, that I'm a very controlling person, so I know I should embrace spontaneity more, but yeah.
Well, when it's forced upon you, you seem to roll with it really well.
I do, yeah.
Well, let's talk about that aspect of what you've been told about yourself, whether it's true or not.
Oh, okay.
But how it relates to structure in Scattered Snows to the North. Do you think it does in how you structured this book?
Oh, how the book is structured?
Yeah. And maybe poems, too, how you're approaching, I don't know. But maybe the book. Maybe we'll start. Well, whatever.
I care about form, and I care about, you know, I guess I think all art has a form, or written art and visual art, you know. Well, music does too,
yes.
Obviously. So, and I think that form and its relationship to content that's how meaning is generated. And I still care about meaning in a world that seems not to. But I don't care. I can care about what I want and always have and shall continue to do so. And so with a book, it matters a great deal to me how it's structured, even though I know that people don't read books the way I think they should, you know, from page one to the end. And that's fine, because I think a good book should be able to open up at any point and provide pleasure. But
the experience you're building.
Right. So if someone wants that, that's what I think is part of the work of, you know, it's one thing to write the poem, and that too, you should have a reader in mind in some way. At least I feel that way. But with a book, it's like, what's going to get a person to want to move through these poems? And what do you want the effect to be? So what happens if this poem comes after that one? What if this image recurs, but, you know, twice at different points? What can that mean? Is it redundant or is it a theme? And so, yeah, structure matters to me.
So let's even talk about some nuts and bolts with this too, like a visible structure where I love how this book feels when you pick it up in your hands. And you can see that it's once you get to the contents that there's three sections.
Uh-huh.
So you've chosen three. But I thought one of the interesting things that I noticed was that each of the sections has its own title rather than a number. And then it's talking to each other because the first section is Somewhere It's Still Summer, which is also this lovely, it's also sort of it's humorous and wistful as you turn the page to see it as the opening page into the book as well. But then it's interesting because then it comes back at the end of the second section, Rehearsal. It's the title poem of it's the last poem of that section.
Yeah, what I did was I had three narrative poems, ones that tell stories or sort of about these people traveling through a landscape. And I had thought that I had more of these poems and that, I've become a narrative poet. And then when I got the poems together, I realized you only have three of these poems, really.
Because usually you're like lyrical. Like you're
right.
You've been always like Carl Phillips.
Right. So poet. I thought, well, you know, maybe since I have three, maybe I'll have three sections. And each one will be the anchor for it. And what it was originally going to be is that whatever the anchor poem was, so the anchor poem for the first section is When We Get There. Mm-hmm. So, and that was the name of that section. And so then at the very last minute, like days before I turned in the manuscript, I decided I'm going to scramble the titles so that Somewhere It's Still Summer is the section opening and you don't really encounter a poem like that until the end of the second section. You think, but wait, that's the section that's called Rehearsal. But wait, Rehearsal, that poem itself is the last poem of the third section.
Which is the last section, and it's the very last poem.
Right. And so then what I liked about that is it, to me, it imposes a kind of intertwining. It suggests that these three discrete things are actually woven together. And then the part of this was because I started noticing that certain images recurred. There's a basin of water where people look at an eclipse, but there's another poem where there's a basin of water. And I didn't like that at first and thought, well, you know, you can't have two basins of water. And I thought, but if it becomes like the echoes of memory where it's like, where did I see that one time? Where did I see a horse swimming in the ocean? And a recurring memory that you can't entirely track. So I like that idea of having these things be stitched together, but not in the predictable way that people usually, whatever the section is called, you see the poem called that in that section. So it was just to play around with it.
And then once you did play,
mm-hmm.
then the order of it then made a certain, it was doing work of like the interconnectedness.
Right.
But then it also is changing the neighboring poems mm-hmm. as well.
Right.
And you're ending on a poem that's called Rehearsal, mm-hmm. which is such a wonderful way out.
Mm-hmm.
Because it isn't the ending.
Right, because rehearsal should be like you're getting started, right. you know, and rehearsal, but it's the last poem. And I also had noticed that, and this was very early at the start, that in that poem Rehearsal that ends the book, these people take off their clothes and swim out. But the opening poem has somebody watching, two people taking off their clothes. And so is it the same two people who were in the first poem or not? You know, and what's about this image of, because both those poems to me are about, at some level, a kind of vulnerability and the ease of being able to be in the presence of another person and naked. And, but the first one, it's a lit scene in daytime. At the end, they're swimming out into the dark sea to an imagined ship. And who knows what that equals. Many people said, is it the ship of death? But that wasn't my intention. It's just, you know,
swimming out. Because it's also because the landscape that many of the poems are within or near is like a liquid. It's either like a dreamscape or the actual landscape mm-hmm. of a coastline or a shoreline or a yeah. marsh. So there's different observations, which I would say throughout here, vivid observations of the natural world as that I think work as like these moments of joy, like you mentioned at the beginning when we first started mm-hmm. talking today, Carl. But boats are within this. Like sure. you'll say there's an absence of boats. So it's already present.
Sure. Yeah. Like memory itself.
And just knowing you the little bit that I do, I would say that couldn't be your last line. You wouldn't want the ship to be death.
No.
Because it would be too final.
Well, also, there's really not a ship there. It just says there's a simile that says it was as
yes,
if there's
yes,
a ship. But
yes.
there's actually not a ship. Everything is exactly as it appeared. And so then they swim out to the dark ship. And so part of what I'm interested in is how we humans tend to want to create figurative images. And, you know, so we say something's like this, but then suddenly it becomes that. But those are distractions from reality.
Because it like blurs into it.
Yeah.
It becomes announced as what it is.
Yeah. So I think, no, I think that's a problem for being an artist as well, is it's sometimes hard to, for me anyway, to keep track of what's real and what's imagined and what's remembered. So did something happen in real life, or have I imagined it to the point where I believe it's true? And is it true at a certain point if I've imagined it long enough? Or is this all a trick of memory that turns out not to be the proof I thought it used to be? I used to think if you can remember something, you can prove it happened. But then all you have to do is talk to somebody else who was present at the same time and remembers it entirely differently, and you realize, oh, I've been wrong all this time. Or they are, but we're never going to know. And yeah, it's one of the many conundrums of being alive.
And once you return to the memory in your mind, mm-hmm. then it's made into a new thing of that memory of the memory.
Right.
So there's layers of it too, Carl, as we age.
Well, right. And I'm finding now that there's also the whole business of when the other party dies. So then I have a newer poem that I don't remember exactly how I put this, but I say something like, as I understand it, it's for me to decide now what exactly happened. Because only the two of us knew. This was a partner of mine who died, a partner I'd broken up with many years ago. And then I had to go back to the house we owned together so I could get some art out of it. And I thought, you know, it's so strange now because I'm the only one who has the truth, as it were, of what our relationship was, what went on in this house. But that's not fair either, because that's just what I remember or how I might choose to remember somebody. But they're not there to speak up for themselves anymore. So I find that interesting too. Speaking of memory being unreliable. But it also is human to create a narrative that makes ourselves look good.
More heroic.
Yeah. So, you know, if the other person isn't around to remind us of our horrible behavior, we can start to forget our horrible behavior and remember that actually, if we were horrible, they provoked it. You know, it can turn into that kind of, you create your own narrative to live with yourself, I think. Why am I talking like this?
What else? Because I think this is just the right day and the right time, Carl Phillips.
Oh, okay.
I feel like these poems are also talking like this.
Yeah.
As well. Like what I think, since we're focusing, we have then the war on the table with us too, but we're focused on scattered snows to the north.
Uh-huh.
And that is actually, that's the space and the voice and the feel of this book. Because there's parts of here, like we're talking about like the lyricism, the imagery, like the osprey, mm-hmm. The plover, you know, like these, the landscapes. But there's a lot of thinking through and opening outward as well within the book.
Yeah. It's kind of how my mind works. It's maddening to people. And a little maddening to me, but what can you do?
Well, I love it. I, for one.
It would be nice to just look at a tree once in a while and say, tree. And that's the end of it.
No, I love how the ginkgos return too in several poems.
Yeah.
Well,
that's
well
because
the spruce and the wind.
Yes, that's because I had a huge ginkgo in my yard in St. Louis. So a lot of these things are very based on just what's
a male or
out
female?
My window. I guess a male. It was a male.
So it wasn't. It wasn't because one is
because one drops the fruit, the seeds, and everything. This one never did that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Will you read a poem? Again, Carl.
Yes.
I think we should. Yeah. If you don't.
I was just thinking, what would happen if I said no?
No.
No, I won't.
Well, no, then we'll keep talking.
Okay. I'm going to read this poem called Stop Shaking. Okay. Not the bell, I said. One of us did. Not the bell, but the smaller sounds, barely noticeable, trapped inside it. It seemed the kind of thing I might say to remind myself, when I've forgotten again, what I want to believe even now matters most, precision, though it's hard these days to know for sure what's true. Isn't every season, no matter what we call it, shadow season? Didn't Timothy used to mean a meadow, a common name, back then at least, for the sweetest grass? I keep making the same avoidable few mistakes that I've always made, and then regretting them, and then regretting them less. Think of all the suffering happening everywhere, all the time, for nothing. What if memories, just the dead, flourishing differently from how they flourished alive? What if?
What if?
Why don't you answer that question, Carl? Because I don't know the answer. I believe in ending a poem honestly, so I'm not going to pretend there's an answer to that.
So when you got to that question, you were like, and now the poem is done.
I don't know if I thought that at the time.
I'm just teasing you.
I probably thought that would be a nice way to end the poem, but you probably can't end it that way. And then it probably took a couple hours for me to say, you can do whatever you want. So, and then later, yeah. Because I think it can be easy, an easy avoidance to end with a question as opposed to digging in and trying to answer it. But I don't know that all questions are meant to be answered. It was one of the things that my students sometimes felt frustrated by when we would look at poems. I sometimes think that a good poem provokes questions for me as a reader and doesn't answer them. And the power of the poem is that I spend days later thinking about that question and learning that I don't have to answer it, that it's just an important question to carry with me. And, you know, because the big questions aren't answerable anyway, I think.
Thank you for saying that, too. That, and it's also about carrying the questions with you.
Yeah, it's like these things that we're supposed to work out of our system, grief or bad behavior, bad ways of being as people. But sometimes I think, you know, like mistakes that we've made in life. And I think people like the idea of they make a mistake and then they want to confess the mistake and be sort of freed of it. And I've always thought that if you make mistakes, and who doesn't, that your part of your responsibility is to live with them and to carry them with you and remember them. It doesn't mean you're necessarily going to change, but it's good to, you know, it seems an easy dodge to confess it to somebody else. And for example, I think this way about something like infidelity. And I think, you know, that can be a very tricky thing to just throw at somebody and tell them. But maybe sometimes it's hard. The harder thing is to say, oh, that happened, and I don't know that was something I feel good about, and I'm going to bear that in mind. Assuming that it was a one-time thing and doesn't mean anything. But I think people are into easy sort of being cleared of it, or we're supposed to go through stages of grief and then be ready to move on. But what about just holding on to that, including also the good parts about whatever person you've lost? That's a harder thing to do, to hold, you know, the hard parts. But it's honest, I think.
Sometimes the pain is something that you still have of them.
Yeah.
After you've lost them.
Yeah. Like yeah, and I don't think that we're supposed to sort of move past that and, yeah.
It's like a living with.
Mm-hmm. It's another part of what's hard about being human, I think, is we carry all this stuff. I think of it as a gigantic sack that's over my shoulder. We carry all this stuff, including wonderful things, you know, a picnic at
treasure.
We remember from when we were 8 years old or yes. something, you know, all these memories, and they get heavier and heavier because you have more that you've accumulated. But that's what you get for having a human brain, I suppose. You know?
Yeah. And I think, like, what do you think about with getting older, Carl? Like our brains are changing just like all our body parts.
Sure.
And like reckoning with that as still being, you know, who we are, our mind.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess I better start thinking about it because I'm 66 years old. But I guess I think, yes. I mean, in taking care of this 91-year-old father of mine who complains a lot about, or constantly tells me, don't get old, don't do this. And I feel as if, you know, I want to get old. I'm looking forward to the adventure of it. I hope it's not going to be hard and painful and difficult for other people, but I'm interested to know what kind of person I might be in my 80s, you know? And I would like to be able to still use my body in the way that I use it, but I've already seen the ways in which I can't do certain things that I used to be able to do. And I don't regret that. Like, oh, why can't I, you know, stay up and dance all night the way I used to? I can't, but I was able just last week to be at a Gregory Alan Isakoff outdoor concert and lie around with my edible. And I thought, I'm enjoying a concert. This is very different from how I enjoyed concerts when I was in my 20s. But here I am, still doing it.
And your whole body and mind dancing and singing, even as you're lying there.
I did have a comeuppance at that concert, though, because I decided I wanted to go up and use the restroom. But it was an outdoor concert, and the sun had gone down. And so I started trying to move around in the dark and started stepping on people or their blankets. And of course, I couldn't get my phone light to go on. And I thought, you know, Carl, the lesson to be learned here, if you're going to be an elder and go to an outdoor concert like this, go to the bathroom before the sun sets. You had a chance and you didn't, and you should have. And you know,
this is our PSA. This is our public service announcement.
But I still want to go to concerts, and so it's just I'll have to think accordingly, or maybe sit closer to the bathroom. You know, there's also that option.
There are options. You
know, but it all worked out. It was fine.
And Carl, the world is our oyster in the future.
Fortunately, I turned in the dark and started shouting my partner's name, and he was right there and said, "I saw you. I saw." He's going to step over people, and you did it. And thanks, partner.
Carl, thanks so much for a super, super hour of radio. I've loved it. Thanks.
See, hardly any poetry, but we've had all this combo.
I think it's all poetry. But there also, thank you for mentioning that. People can go and see you this week at UMA. You'll be on Thursday, tomorrow.
Yes.
You'll be there at 5:30. Mm-hmm. So Carl Phillips at UMA, 5:30 for the Zell Visiting Writers Series. You can also Google that online. Carl will be doing a craft talk as well on Friday morning.
Yes.
And folks, you can join in person, and there's also usually a tiny URL where you could join virtually.
Yeah.
So many ways to keep this going and have more poems, more Carl Phillips poems in your life.
Sure.
Which I think is a good thing for us all. Thanks so much, Carl, for being here.
Thank you, T. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. And thanks, Mom, out there listening. Thanks to Jason for engineering. Until next time.
Washington and Lee Swing by the Bobcats, as today we feature Bob Crosby.
Jazz Revisited.
Hello and welcome to the 21st century edition of Jazz Revisited. My name is DJ Tone, and it's my privilege to bring to you this show originally broadcast in 1967, now on WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
Jazz Revisited, a review of the first three decades of recorded American jazz, 1917 to 1947. The artists and their music. A program produced at the University of Michigan. And now, here is your host, Hazen Schumacher.
The Ben Pollack Band was one of the best white dance bands, jazz bands, in the late 20s and early 30s. And when